Matthew was standing in its shade, reading a book. He was absorbed enough that he didn't hear the door shut, or notice James coming toward him across the grass until James had nearly reached him. He looked up, and his green eyes widened. "James," he said, and the word sounded like an exhale of relief. He quickly schooled his face into a frown. "I don't know whether to embrace you as a brother or strike you down as a foe." "I vote the first one," said James. "I suppose it isn't really fair to be angry about last night," Matthew mused. "I imagine you have very little control over what happens when you go into the Shadow Realm. But once your father had finished shouting at us all in Welsh for breaking his window and letting you leave, the news came through that they tracked you to Chiswick House, and I did wonder." "Wonder what?" James perched himself on the arm of a white garden bench. "Whether you'd use the Shadow Realm to go and see Grace," said Matthew. "I mean, what else is there in Chiswick? Nothing interesting." "I didn't go there voluntarily," said James. "Then tell me what happened," said Matthew, tucking his novel into the crook of a tree. "Actually, wait." He held up a hand just as James had started to speak. "Wait, wait. I shall murder you if this keeps up," said James. Matthew grinned, and there was the sound of barking. Boisterous hellos bounced off the garden walls. Thomas and Christopher, having paused to greet a tail-wagging Oscar, were running down the back steps of the house. "James," Christopher called as they got closer, "what happened last night? Where'd you disappear to?"
"There you go, James," Matthew said smugly. "Now you don't have to tell the story more than once." "Yes, what happened to you last night?" said Thomas. "You just vanished, you know." Matthew was about to rip the Institute apart brick by brick to see if you'd fallen into the crypt when your father tracked you to Chiswick. "Why Chiswick?" Christopher wondered aloud. "Nothing interesting happens there."
"It has now," said Matthew cheerfully.
Before the conversation could degenerate further, James explained how he had gone into the world of shadows, how he had followed a light and found himself in the greenhouse. He described the warped Cerberus demon and how he had killed it. When he got to the part about Lucy and Cordelia, Matthew began to look less cheerful. "What on earth were they doing there?" he said. "They'd gone to check on Miss Blackthorn and see if she was all right," said James, who wasn't sure he believed this particular story himself. Lucy had had her bright-eyed storytelling face on. As for Cordelia, he realised with a slight jolt that he doubted he'd be able to tell if she was lying to him or not. He didn't know her that well, though he felt as if he ought to.
"Seems dangerous to be out and about at night after those attacks," said Matthew. "Lucy, the girls, shouldn't be taking such risks."
"As if you're going to stop going out at night," Thomas pointed out.
He and Christopher had sprawled on the grass while James was talking. Matthew was leaning against the plane tree, absently stroking Oscar's head.
"Here's my question. Why Lightwood? I mean, Chiswick House. Why the greenhouse?"
"No idea," said James, keeping his thoughts about Cortana to himself. They were too vague and would only confuse things. "Perhaps because the demon was there?"
"Demons do like to take up residence in ruins, especially those where there are remnants of black magic," said Christopher. "And we all know what Grandfather Benedict was up to in that house. It's why he turned into a worm."
"Ah," said Matthew, "fond family memories."
"Well, the Clave agrees with you," said James. "They believe the demon has been there since Benedict's time. And while it seems entirely unconnected to the attacks, I do feel we have been seeing an unusual number of demons lately in rather unusual places."
"Demons in unusual places" was Benedict's motto, said Matthew, tossing a stick for Oscar.
"How do we know what the Clave thinks?
Charles has been remarkably tight-lipped."
"Not to me," said James. "He came to see me this morning." Thomas's expression darkened.
Don't tell me he believes all that poppycock about you going to see Miss Blackthorne and being refused.
He does believe it, said James, not wanting to hear the story again. He was already annoyed at himself for having let Charles get to him where Grace was concerned. Of course, Charles knew nothing significant about her. Or, at least, I was unable to give him another, better explanation. I cannot say I was wandering about the Shadow Realm. Better, I suppose, that they think I am a lunatic in love.
But you barely know Miss Blackthorne, said Christopher, nibbling a piece of grass.
James's eyes met Matthew's. Matthew was looking at him with sympathy, but there was a clear statement in his green eyes. It's time.
I do know Grace, said James, and I do love her.
He explained about the summers in Idris, Blackthorne Manor next door, and the hours he'd spent with Grace in Brosseland, painting pictures in words for her of London, the great city she had never seen. He explained that Tatiana Blackthorne loathed him and spoke of Charles's admonition that he stay away from the Blackthorns. By the time he was done, the first stars were beginning to come out in the darkening sky. Christopher was the first to speak.
I didn't know that you were in love with someone, James. I'm sorry. I should have been paying attention.
I didn't know either, said Thomas, and I have been paying attention.
James said, I am sorry I didn't tell you before. Grace is always worried that her mother would find out and be furious. Even Lucy does not know. Though he realized Cordelia did. It had not even seemed strange to tell her. Thomas was frowning.
My Aunt Tatiana is mad. My father has often said so, that his sister was driven to madness by what happened to her father and her husband. She blames our parents for their deaths.
But James has never done anything to her, said Christopher, his eyebrows knitting together.
He's a Herondale, said Thomas. That's enough.
That's ridiculous, Christopher said. It is as if one was bitten by a duck, and years later one shot a completely different duck and ate it for dinner and called that revenge.
Please do not use metaphors, Christopher, said Matthew. It gives me the pip.
This is bad enough without mentioning ducks, said James. He had never fancied ducks since one had bitten him in Hyde Park as a small child.
I'm sorry, Thomas. I feel as if I have failed in helping Barbara.
No, Thomas said quickly. We have only just started.
I was thinking, perhaps you and I and Matthew should go to the Devil Tavern and look through the book collection. There are volumes there that the Clave will never find combing through the Institute's library. We could see if there is any mention of these daylight demon creatures.
What about Christopher? Said Matthew.
Christopher held up a vial filled with a red substance. I managed to acquire some blood that the Silent Brothers had taken from one of the patients last night, he said proudly. I intend to mix modern science and shadow hunter magic to attempt to create an antidote for the demon poison. Henry has said I can use his laboratory while he is in Idris.
Thomas squinted. That had better not be my sister's blood.
It's Piers's, said Christopher, though for the sake of pure science it should not matter.
And yet we are all relieved, said James. Matthew and I can go to Fleet Street. Perhaps Thomas should help Christopher in the lab.
Thomas sighed. I always end up helping Christopher in the lab.
It is because you are remarkably good at dodging explosions, said James. And also, you can curse in Spanish.
How does that help? Said Thomas.
It doesn't, said James, but Christopher likes it. Now,
James!
It was Henry calling from the house. James sprinted away. Oscar had fallen asleep in the grass, his paws sticking up into the air. There was a short silence. Matthew took his book from the tree and brushed off the cover.
Grace, Thomas said finally. What is she like? I don't think we've exchanged two words.
Very shy, said Matthew. Very quiet, looks painfully frightened a great deal of the time, yet always admired at social events.
That's odd, said Thomas. Not really, said Christopher. Men like the idea of a woman they can rescue.
Both Matthew and Thomas looked at him in amazement. He shrugged.
I heard my mother say it once, he said. Seems true in this case.
Do you think she's in love with James? Said Thomas.
Because he seems gone on her. I hope it's not unrequited. She had better love him back, said Matthew. He deserves it. We don't always love people who deserve it, said Thomas quietly.
Maybe not, said Matthew, but often we don't love those who don't deserve it, and very right too.
His fingers gripped the book he held so tightly that they had gone pale.
Thomas put his finger to his lips. James had returned carrying a letter. The address had been written in a decidedly feminine hand, J.H., care of Matthew Fairchild. Urgent.
Someone sent you a letter here, said Thomas curiously.
Is it from Grace?
James, who had already scanned the first few lines, nodded. She didn't want to risk getting me in hot water with the enclave. She knew I'd either be here or Matthew would find me and deliver the message. He was quite sure his friends had been talking about him while he was gone, but he didn't mind it. His relief at seeing Grace's writing felt like a palpable thing. The loops and scrolls of her hand were as familiar to him as the forest outside Herondale Manor.
So, what does she say? Said Matthew.
She adores your face and yearns to run her fingers through your messy raven hair. She wants me to meet her tonight, at 10, James said. He slipped the letter into his pocket, his mind racing. I had better go. I have no way to get a message back to her, and I'll have to walk. The streets are entirely snarled up with traffic.
You can't walk all the way to Chiswick, Thomas protested.
James shook his head. Of course not. She proposed a spot in London, a place Matthew and I used to do balancing exercises. I've described it to her before.
Still, Matthew looked hesitant. Is it wise? My brother is an idiot, but if the Enclave wants you to stay away from the Blackthorns...
I must, said James, not wanting to explain. He knew his friends, and they would insist on coming with him if he did. Better to leave now and let them think his concern was a purely romantic one. He bent to rub Oscar's head and said, Thomas, Christopher, you handle the laboratory work. Matthew, I will find you when I return from meeting Grace, and we will go to the devil.
I am always going to the devil, said Matthew, a glint in his eye. I shall be at the tavern by midnight. Join me there when you can.
James excused himself and hurried from the house. The letter in his pocket seemed to beat against his chest like a second heart. Over and over he saw the last line Grace had written.
I shall wait there. And pray that you come. Help me, James. I am in danger.
Alistair dropped Cordelia off at Anna's house with a perfunctory pat on the head and a promise to return just before 9 o'clock. Since their mother usually served dinner at 9, this seemed to Cordelia to be cutting it rather close, but he rattled off in the carriage before she could even ask him where he was going. She couldn't say she was entirely surprised. With a sigh, Cordelia turned to face Percy Street, a small side street near Tottenham Court Road. It was made up of long rows of houses of red brick that all looked very much the same. Each had sash windows, white-painted doors, brick chimneys, a shallow set of steps, and a fence about the servants' entrance made of black wrought iron. On the stairs in front of number 30, a girl sat crying. She was a very fashionable girl, in a walking dress of blue foulard, with lace trimmings and acres of flounces about the skirt. She wore a headband trimmed with silk roses, and they wobbled as she cried. Cordelia checked the address she had written down, hoping it would have changed. Alas, definitely number 30. She sighed, squared her shoulders, and approached. "Pardon me," she said as she reached the steps. The girl was blocking them completely. There was no way to politely edge past. I'm here to see Anna Lightwood? The girl's head jerked up. She was very pretty, blonde and rosy-cheeked, though she'd been crying.
Who are you, then? She demanded.
Cordelia peered more closely at the girl. Definitely a mundane. No marks, no glamour.
I'm her cousin.
It wasn't quite true, but it seemed the right thing to say.
Oh.
Some of the suspicion went out of the girl's face.
I am here because, well, because it's just too awful.
Might I inquire as to the problem? Cordelia asked, though she rather dreaded finding out what it was, as it seemed the sort of thing where she might have to come up with a solution.
Anna,
the girl wept.
I loved her. I love her still. I would have given it all up for her, all of it, polite society and all its rules, just to be with her. But she has thrown me out like a dog on the street.
Now, Evangeline, drawled a voice, and Cordelia looked up to see Anna leaning out of an upstairs window.
She was wearing a man's dressing gown in rich purple and gold brocade, and her hair was a cap of loose, short waves.
You can't say you've been thrown out like a dog when you've got your mamma, two footmen and a butler coming for you.
She waved.
Hello, Cordelia.
Oh dear, said Cordelia, and patted Evangeline gently on the shoulder.
Besides, Evangeline, said Anna, you're to be married Wednesday to a baronet.
I don't want him.
Evangeline sprang to her feet.
I want you.
No, said Anna. You want a baronet, not to live in my messy little flat. Now go on, Evangeline. There's a good girl.
Evangeline burst into a fresh spate of tears.
I thought I was the one, she wept. After all the other girls, I thought they didn't mean anything.
They didn't, Anna said cheerfully. And neither did you. Do come up, Cordelia, the water's already boiled.
Evangeline let out a wail that made Cordelia jump back in fear for her life. She leaped to her feet, her blonde curls flying.
I shall not stand for this, she announced. I'm coming back in.
Anna looked alarmed.
Cordelia, please stop her. My landlady hates fusses.
There was the sound of hoofbeats pounding along the road, growing rapidly louder. A light carriage, drawn by two matched greys, hurtled up the street. A Juno-esque woman in a flared skirt and a redingot perched upon the driver's box seat. She pulled up briskly in front of the house and turned a furious face toward number 30.
Evangeline, she roared, get into this carriage this instant.
The fire went out of Evangeline.
Yes, Mamma,
she squeaked, and darted into the carriage. The plumes on Evangeline's mother's hat trembled as she gazed sternly at Anna, perched in her sash window, examining an unlit cigar.
You, she shouted, you are a disgrace, breaking girls' hearts like that, an absolute disgrace, sir. If it were but a century ago, I should slap a glove in your face, decidedly.
Anna burst out laughing. The door of the carriage slammed and the horses broke into a gallop. The carriage wheels squealed as the conveyance rocketed around the corner and was soon out of sight. Anna glanced down at Cordelia pleasantly.
Do come up, she said. I am on the second floor and will leave that door open for you.
Feeling as if she had been winged by a typhoon, Cordelia made her way up the stairs and into a slightly shabby entryway. A lamp glowed in an alcove halfway up the inside steps. The rug was threadbare, and the banister rail so splintered she feared to touch it, and she nearly tripped up the last three shallow steps. Anna's door was, as she had said, wide open. The flat inside was much pleasanter than Cordelia had imagined, given the state of the hallway. Softly coloured old Victorian wallpaper in dark green and gold, a haphazard scatter of furniture that didn't match but looked glorious anyway, like warring armies who had found a peculiarly harmonious peace. There was a fearsomely large sofa of worn deep gold velvet, some winged armchairs with tweedy pillows, a Turkish rug, and a Tiffany lamp of a dozen colours of glass. The mantle of the fireplace was decorated with a multitude of knives that had been stuck into it at odd angles, each with a jewelled, glittering hilt. Atop a small table by the bedroom door was a large, vibrantly coloured stuffed snake with two heads. "I see that you're examining Percival," said Anna, gesturing at the serpent. "Spectacular, isn't he?" She stood in front of the sash window, looking out as the sun sank behind the rooftops of London. Her dressing gown fell open about her long body, and beneath it Cordelia could see that she was wearing dark trousers and a sheer white gentleman's shirt. It was unbuttoned to below her clavicle. Her skin was only a shade darker than the whiteness of the shirt, and her hair, curling at the back of her neck, was the same black as James's. Herondale black. The colour of the wing of a crow. "He's certainly brightly coloured," said Cordelia. "He was a love gift. I never do court dull girls." Anna turned to look at Cordelia, the dressing gown sweeping around her like wings. Her features were not what Cordelia would ever have called pretty. She was striking, stunning, even. Pretty seemed too small and imprecise a word for Anna. "Did that woman call you sir?" said Cordelia curiously. "Did she think you were a man?"
"Possibly." Anna flicked her cigar into the fireplace. "Best to let people believe what they want to believe, in my experience."
She threw herself onto the sofa. No braces held up her trousers, but unlike the men for whom they were tailored, she had hips, and the trousers hung from them, clinging close to her slight curves.
"Poor Evangeline," said Cordelia, undoing the strap that held Cortana and leaning her sword against the wall.
Settling her skirts about her, she sat down in one of the armchairs. Anna sighed.
"This is not the first time I have tried to break it off with her," she said. "The last few times I was gentler, but as her wedding day drew near, I felt one must be cruel to be kind. I had never wanted her life ruined."
She leaned forward, her focus on Cordelia.
"Now, Cordelia Carstairs, tell me all your secrets."
"I think I had better not," said Cordelia. "I don't know you very well."
Anna laughed. "Are you always so straightforward? Why did you come to tea if you didn't want to gossip?"
"I didn't say I didn't want to gossip, just not about myself."
Anna's smile deepened.
"You're a vexing little thing," she said, though she didn't sound vexed. "Oh, the kettle."
She leaped up in a swirl of glimmering brocade and busied herself in the small kitchen. It had brightly painted walls and a small window that looked out onto the brick facade of the building opposite.
"Well then, if you want to gossip but you don't want to tell me about yourself, why don't you tell me about your brother? Is he as awful as he used to be at school?"
"Did you go to school with Alistair?"
Cordelia was surprised. Surely Alistair would have mentioned it.
"No. James and Matthew and the rest of the merry thieves did. And Matthew says he was a miserable blighter and gave them all the pip. No offence meant. I admit, Thomas never says a bad word about him.
Sugar?
I haven't any milk."
"No sugar," said Cordelia,
and Anna whirled back into the parlour with tea in a chipped cup and saucer. She handed it to Cordelia, who balanced it awkwardly on her knees.
"Alistair is rather awful," she admitted, "but I don't think he means to be."
"Do you think he's in love?" Anna said. "People can be awful when they're in love."
"I don't know who he'd be in love with," Cordelia said. "He's hardly had time to fall in love with anyone since we've just arrived in London, and I doubt everything that's happened has put anyone in a falling in love mood."
"What did your father do, exactly?" Anna said.
"What?"
Cordelia nearly spilled her tea.
Well, we all know he did something dreadful, said Anna, and that your mother's come here to try to ingratiate herself back into Shadowhunter society. I hope everyone won't be too stiff-necked about it. I quite like your mother. She reminds me of a queen out of a fairy tale, or a peri from Lalaruk. You're half Persian, aren't you?
Yes,
Cordelia said a little warily.
Then why is your brother so blonde? Anna asked, and you so red-headed. I thought Persians were darker-haired.
Cordelia set her cup down. There are all sorts of Persians, and we all look different, she said. You wouldn't expect everyone in England to look alike, would you? Why should it be different for us? My father is British and very fair, and my mother's hair was red when she was a little girl. Then it darkened. And as for Alistair, he dyes his hair.
He does.
Anna's eyebrows, graceful swooping curves, went up.
Why?
Because he hates that his hair and his skin and eyes are dark, said Cordelia. He always has. We have a country house in Devon, and people used to stare when we went into the village.
Anna's eyebrows had ceased swooping and taken on a decidedly menacing look.
People are...
She broke off with a sigh and a word Cordelia didn't know. Now I rather feel sympathy toward your brother, and that was the last thing I wanted. Quick, ask me a question.
Why did you want to get to know me? Cordelia said. I'm younger than you, and you must know loads more interesting people.
Anna rose and her silk robe fluttered. I must get changed, she said, vanishing into the bedroom. She closed the door, but the walls were thin. Cordelia could hear her perfectly well when she spoke again.
Well, at first, it was because you're a new girl in our set, and I was wondering if you were good enough for our Jamie or our Matthew.
Good enough for them in what sense?
Well, marriage, of course, said Anna. Anything else would be scandalous.
Cordelia sputtered. She heard Anna laugh. She had a soft, rich laugh, like melting butter.
You are too much fun to tease, she said. I meant good enough to know their secrets. And Christopher's and Tom's as well. They are my special favourites, those four. You must have noticed. And, well, the current crop of girls in London is rather dire. Of course, Lucy's a delight, but she'll never look at any of the boys as anything but brothers.
Seems sensible, Cordelia murmured, especially in James's case.
They need a muse, said Anna, someone to be inspired by, someone to know their secrets. Would you like to be a muse?
No, said Cordelia. I would like to be a hero.
Anna poked her head out of the door and looked at Cordelia for a long time from under her dark lashes. Then she smiled.
I suspected as much, she said, vanishing back into the bedroom.
The door banged shut.
That's really why I asked you here.
Cordelia's head was spinning.
What do you mean?
We are in danger, called Anna. All of us. And the Clave will not see it. I'm afraid if steps are not taken, it will be too late for Barbara and Piers and Ariadne.
There was a slight tremor in her voice.
I need your help.
But what can I?
Cordelia began, and broke off as she heard the downstairs front door bang open.
Anna?
A deep male voice echoed up the stairwell. It was soon joined by the tread of running feet, and Matthew Fairchild burst into Anna's parlour.
8. No Strange Land.
But, when so sad thou canst not sadder cry, and upon thy so sore loss shall shine the traffic of Jacob's ladder, pitched betwixt heaven and Charing Cross. Francis Thompson, In No Strange Land. Matthew wore a brocade waistcoat, and a new silk hat was clutched in his hand,
though his head was bare, his curls tousled. Shimmering stones glittered in his tie pin and at his cuffs, and his signet ring gleamed on his hand.
Anna, you won't believe...
He broke off as he saw Cordelia.
What are you doing here?
Cordelia was not sure such a rude question deserved an answer.
Having tea.
His gaze scanned the room. His eyes were a most peculiar colour, clear green in some lights, darker in others.
I don't see Anna, he said,
sounding astonished and a little suspicious, as if he suspected Cordelia of having hidden Anna in the teapot.
She's in her bedroom, said Cordelia, as coolly as she could manage.
Alone? Matthew inquired.
Matthew, called Anna from the bedroom, don't be awful.
Matthew went to lean against Anna's bedroom door, turning his head to speak to her through the crack. It was clear he didn't care whether Cordelia overheard him.
I have already had a maddening day, he said. James has been slandered by Tatiana Blackthorne, and my rotten older brother is backing her up to the hilt. James has gone off to rendezvous with Grace. I am here to get squiffy and try to forget what a foolish thing my parapetai is doing.
He glanced at his watch.
Also, I have to be at Fleet Street by midnight.
Anna reemerged, looking spectacular in a black velvet coat, matching trousers, and a white silk shirt tied at the collar. A monocle dangled around her neck, and her boots were shimmering black. Between her and Matthew, it was hard to say who looked the more, as if they had wandered out of an illustration in Punch regarding the glamorous youth of today.
A dreadful tale, Anna said. Shall we go?
Certainly, said Matthew. Cordelia, it was lovely, if surprising, to see you.
There is no need to say farewell, Anna said, drawing on a pair of white gloves. Cordelia will be coming with us. That was why I invited her here in the first place.
I thought you wanted to have tea, objected Cordelia.
No one ever just wants to have tea, said Anna. Tea is always an excuse for a clandestine agenda.
Anna, Cordelia is a proper young lady, said Matthew. She may not wish to risk her reputation by sallying out with downworlders and reprobates.
Cordelia wants to be a hero, said Anna. One cannot do that by staying at home stitching samplers.
Her eyes gleamed. I was at the Enclave meeting today. You were not. I know how the Enclave has decided to handle our current situation, and I do not think it will help those who are stricken, or prevent the attack at the lake from happening again. When Matthew spoke, the brashness had gone out of his voice.
I thought Barbara was getting better.
Thomas said,
The Silent Brothers have put all the wounded to sleep,
said Cordelia, who had heard this from Alistair.
They hope they will heal, but...
Hope is not a solution, said Anna.
The Clave insists this was a random demon attack, which took place not in daylight but under cloud cover. They have set patrols in Regent's Park.
It was not random, said Cordelia. There were mundanes in the park too. None were attacked.
And the demons came before the cloud cover did, said Matthew. When Piers fell screaming, the sun was still visible.
You begin to see the problem, said Anna. Several Enclave members made those points, among them my parents. But the majority prefer to think of this as the sort of problem they have faced before, not something new.
And you think it's something new? Said Cordelia.
I am sure of it, said Anna. And when a new supernatural threat enters London, who are the first to know of it? Downworlders. We should be asking questions in Downworld. There was a time when the Clave had connections with high warlocks, with the leaders of the vampire and werewolf clans, with the queen of the Seelie court. She shook her head in frustration. I know Uncle Will and Aunt Tessa have done all they can, but these alliances have been left to fray. And now Shadowhunters can only imagine relying on themselves.
I see, said Matthew, whose eyes had begun to sparkle. We shall be going to the Hell Ruel, then.
Matthew and I occasionally attend an artistic salon in a building owned by the High Warlock of London, said Anna. Malcolm Fade.
Malcolm Fade?
Cordelia had heard of him. High Warlocks of cities were sometimes elected. Sometimes they simply claimed the title. Malcolm Fade had appeared in London somewhere around the turn of the century and announced that he would be High Warlock as Ragnar Fell was stepping down, and no one had seen Magnus Bane recently. Lucy had been electrified, especially when he came to pay a call on the Institute and chat with Will and Tessa. She said he had the hair the colour of salt and eyes the colour of violets, and she had been in love with him for almost a week, her letters full of nothing else. Every downworlder who is anyone will be there, said Anna. It's time for us to do what we do best. Drink, said Matthew. Be charming, said Anna. Ask questions. See what we can learn. She held out a gloved hand. Come, come, get up. Is the carriage downstairs, Matthew? At your service, said Matthew. Are you quite sure you want to come, Cordelia? It will be scandalous. Cordelia didn't bother to reply, just retrieved Cortana as they left the flat. It was dark outside. The air was chilly and dank. A carriage with the consul's coat of arms painted across the door waited for them at the curb. Someone had left a pile of roses with the heads snipped off on the front steps. Evangeline or a different girl?
So what kind of salon is this exactly? Cordelia inquired, as the carriage door swung open and Matthew helped her inside.
One of the consul's servants, a middle-aged man with brown hair, sat impassively up front in the box seat. She had heard of salons, of course, gatherings where the great and the famous and the noble came together to appreciate art and poetry. It was rumoured that more daring things happened at salons as well, in the shadows and the dark gardens, couples gathering to tryst where no one could see them. Anna and Matthew scrambled up after her, Anna disdaining Matthew's helping hand. An exclusive one, said Anna, settling back on the velvet bench seat. Some of the most famous downworlders in the world attend. The carriage set off at a clip. Anna said, some you may have heard of, some you may not, some with reputations they don't deserve, and some with reputations they more than do.
I never thought of downworlders as being interested in painting and poetry, said Cordelia, but I suppose there is no reason they shouldn't be, is there? It's just those aren't things that shadow hunters do. We don't create like that.
We can, Matthew said. We are simply told we shouldn't. Do not confuse conditioning with a native inability.
Do you create, Matthew? Asked Cordelia, looking at him sharply. Do you draw? Or paint, or pen poetry?
Lucy writes, said Matthew, his eyes like dark water. I thought she wrote for you sometimes.
Lucy worries, said Cordelia. She doesn't say so, but I know she worries, that all her writing will come to nothing, because she is a shadow hunter, and that must come first. She hesitated. What does it mean, Hel Ruel?
Anna's eyes gleamed. She said,
Official academic gatherings in Paris have always been controlled by men, but salons are a world ruled by women. One famous noble lady seated her artistic guests in her ruelle, the space between her bed, any lady's bed really, and the wall. A scandalous spot. Informally, an artistic gathering presided over by a woman came to be known as a ruelle.
But you said Malcolm Fade ran this one, I thought.
He owns the building, said Anna. As for who runs it, you will see soon enough.
Cordelia did not like having to wait to find things out. She sighed and glanced at the window. Where are we going?
Berwick Street, said Anna and dropped a wink. In Soho.
Cordelia didn't know much of London, but she did know that Soho was where bohemians roamed. Dissolute writers and starving artists
Penniless socialists and aspiring musicians rubbed shoulders with a mix of shopkeepers, tradesmen, aristocrats who had fallen down in the world, and ladies who were no better than they should be. It had always sounded wildly exciting, and exactly the sort of place her mother would never let her go.
Soho,
she breathed, as the carriage rattled down a narrow, dark street, on whose pavement the stalls of a public market had been set up. Naphtha beacons illuminated the faces of stall owners, chatting and haggling with customers over chipped china plates and mugs and second-hand clothes. Gentlemen, well, they weren't gentlemen, most likely, Cordelia thought, tried on overcoats and jackets in the street, their wives fingering the material and exclaiming on the fit. Boswell's butcher had thrown its doors open and was selling cuts of meat by gaslight. Whatever will spoil before tomorrow, darling, Anna said, noting Cordelia's curious stare, and there were bakers and grocers doing the same. They passed a tea shop, and then the Blue Post's pub, its windows alive with light. Here, said Anna, and the carriage stopped. They scrambled out and found themselves at the corner of Berwick and a small alley called Tyler's Court, leading away from the main thoroughfare. The air was full of the sound of people laughing and shouting, and the smell of roasting nuts. After a brief whispered conference with Matthew, Anna disappeared down the alley, her tall, black-clad form melding almost immediately with the shadows. Cordelia was left alone with Matthew. He had his hat tipped down over one eye and was regarding her thoughtfully. Cordelia glanced about at the shop signs. She could see the silhouettes of women lounging in doorways. She thought of her mother's voice saying, "A fallen woman, you know," as if the girl in question had merely overbalanced. Cordelia tried to imagine it, kissing men for money, doing more than just kissing. "What are you thinking?" Matthew asked. Cordelia wrenched her gaze away from a woman with rouged cheeks smiling up at a man in ill-fitting labourer's clothes. "What's a lapidary?" she asked, not because she actually wanted to know, but because the sign opposite her said, "A. Jones, lapidary," and Matthew was making her nervous. "A lapidary phrase is one that is worth carving into stone," said Matthew, "and preserving forever. A wise saying such as, 'We are dust and shadows,' or, alternately, any words that come out of my mouth." Cordelia pointed at the sign. "They sell phrases there." "They sell objects with phrases carved into them," Matthew said. "For instance, if you wished words of love to be etched into your wedding band, or words of regret and sorrow on your grave. For my own headstone, I was hoping for something a bit grand."
"You surprise me," said Cordelia. "I am all astonishment."
Matthew threw his arms up in the air, his face glowing in the naphtha beacons. "Perhaps a simple, 'O grave, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting?' But does that truly capture the light I brought to the lives of friends and acquaintances? The sorrow they will feel when it is extinguished? Perhaps, 'Shed not for him the bitter tear, nor give the heart to vain regret. 'Tis but the casket that lies here. The gem that filled it sparkles yet.'" Matthew's voice had risen. Applause rose from the crowd outside the Blue Posts when he was finished. He lowered his arms just as Anna emerged from the alley. "Do stop babbling rot, Matthew," she said. "Now come along, the both of you. They're expecting us." It was deep night, the forest deep and dark. The beautiful Cordelia, astride her white palfrey, galloped along the twisting road that gleamed white in the moon's graceful light. Her shining scarlet hair blew behind her, and her radiantly beautiful face was set with steely determination. Suddenly she cried out. A black stallion had appeared, blocking the road ahead of her. She pulled back on the reins, skidding to a halt with a gasp. It was him, the man from the inn. She recognized his handsome face, his radiant green eyes. Her head swam. What could he possibly be doing out here in the midst of the night, wearing very tight breeches?
"My word," he said, his voice heavy with sarcasm. "I was warned that the ladies in this neighborhood were fast, but I didn't think that was meant to be taken literally."
Cordelia gasped. The nerve of him. "Pray remove yourself from my path, sir, for I have an urgent errand this night, upon whose completion many lives depend."
Lucy reached the end of her sentence and her typewriter ribbon and clapped her hands together in delight.
"Pray remove yourself from my path, sir." Cordelia had such spirit,
and sparks were about to fly between her and the handsome highwayman, who was, in reality, a duke's son, convicted of a crime he hadn't committed and forced to make his living on the roads. It was all so romantic.
"Miss Herondale?" said a soft voice behind her.
Lucy, seated at her desk by the window, turned in surprise. She had forgotten to kindle the witchlight in her room, as dusk had fallen, and for a moment all she could see was a male figure in dark clothes, standing smack in the centre of her bedroom. She shrieked. When nothing happened, she shrieked again, lifted the neat stack of completed pages that she'd set aside, and hurled it at the figure in the middle of the room. He leaped aside nimbly, but not nimbly enough. The manuscript struck him and exploded into a white cloud of paper. Lucy reached toward the lamp on her desk. In the sudden illumination, she saw him clearly. Black hair, as pin-straight as her brother's, was wild and untidy. Green eyes looked out at her beneath dark lashes.
"So this is what people mean when they say the pages just flew by," said Jesse dryly, as the last of the papers settled to his feet. "Was that necessary?"
"Was it necessary to invade my bedroom?" Lucy demanded, her hands on her hips. She could feel her heart pounding and was a little surprised at herself. It wasn't as if seeing ghosts was that rare an occurrence for her. Jessamine drifted in and out of Lucy's bedroom frequently. She loved to look at Lucy's clothes when she took them out of the wardrobe and to give her unwanted fashion advice. Lucy had been almost 10 years old before she'd realised, when Rosamond and Piers Wentworth had laughed at her, that most girls didn't have a pestering ghost friend. Jessie had picked up a page and was looking at it critically.
"Too many uses of the word radiant," he said, at least 3 times on the same page. Also, golden and shining.
"I don't recall asking your advice," Lucy said, rising to her feet.
Thank goodness she had changed for dinner and wasn't still sitting about in her dressing gown. She did sometimes forget to get dressed when deep into a story, the words flying from her fingers.
"What was the last book you read?"
"Great Expectations," he said promptly. "I told you, I read a great deal." He sat down on the edge of Lucy's bed and immediately leaped back up, blushing. Lucy took her hands off her hips, amused.
"A ghost with a sense of propriety. That is funny."
He looked at her darkly. He really did have a most arresting face, she thought. His black hair and green eyes made a wintry contrast against his pale skin. As a writer, one had to pay attention to these things. Descriptions were very important.
"There is actually a purpose in my coming here," he said.
"Other than mocking and humiliating me, I'm so glad."
Jessie ignored this.
"My sister and your brother have arranged a secret rendezvous tonight."
"Oh, by the angel."
It was Lucy's turn to sit down heavily on the edge of her bed.
"That's dreadfully awkward."
Before Jessie could say another word, the bedroom door jerked open and Lucy's father stood on the threshold looking alarmed.
"Lucy," he said, "did you call out? I thought I heard you."
Lucy tensed, but the expression in her father's blue eyes didn't change. Mild worry mixed with curious puzzlement. He really couldn't see Jessie.
Jessie looked at her and very irritatingly shrugged as if to say, I told you so.
No, Papa, she said. Everything is all right.
He looked at the manuscript pages scattered all over the rug.
Spot of writer's block, Lulu.
Jessie raised an eyebrow. Lulu, he mouthed. Lucy considered whether it was possible to die of humiliation. She did not dare look at Jessie. She stared straight at her father instead. He still looked worried.
Is something wrong, Papa?
Will shook his head. Lucy could not remember when the white threads at his temples had appeared, salting the black of his hair.
Long ago, he said, I was the one warning the Clave that something terrible was coming, a threat we did not know how to face. Now I am the Clave, and I still cannot convince those around me that more steps should be taken than simply setting patrols in a park.
Is that really all they are doing?
Your mother believes the answer is to be found in the library, Will said, running his fingers distractedly through his hair.
The backs of her father's hands were scarred from a demon attack that had happened years ago, when Lucy was a child.
Your Uncle Jem believes the warlocks may have some useful knowledge hidden in their spiral labyrinth.
And what do you believe? Said Lucy.
I believe there are always those who stay vigilant and seek the truth rather than easy answers, he said, with a smile that Lucy could tell was more for her than for himself. In the meantime, I shall be with your mother in the library. We are still under the A section of the Unusual Demons book. Who knew there was a worm-like creature called the Ardshak common in Sri Lanka?
Cordelia, perhaps, said Lucy. She has been everywhere.
She frowned.
Is it selfishly awful to worry that all this business will delay our becoming Parabatai? I feel I will be a better shadow hunter when it is done. Were you not one, after you became Parabatai with Uncle Jem?
A better shadow hunter and a better man, said Will. All the best of me I learned from Jem and your mother. All I want for you and Cordelia is to have what I had, a friendship that will shape all your days, and never to be parted.
Lucy knew that her parents had done great deeds that had become famous Nephilim stories, but they had suffered too much. Lucy had long ago decided that living in a story would be terribly uncomfortable. Far better to write them, and control the tale so it was never too sad or too scary, only just enough to be intriguing.
Will sighed. Get some sleep, Vernariadbach. Hopefully our infirmary dwellers will be better tomorrow.
The door clicked shut behind her father, and Lucy gazed around her shadowed room. Where was her ghost?
Well, that was interesting, said Jessie in a thoughtful voice.
Lucy spun around and glared at Jessie, who was sitting on the windowsill, all pale skin and dark eyebrows like slashes in his face. He did not reflect against the glass panes. They were black and empty behind him.
You're just lucky I didn't tell him you were here, she said. He would have believed me, and if he thought there was a boy in his daughter's room, he would have figured out how to tear him limb from limb, even if he couldn't see him.
Jessie didn't seem particularly concerned.
What did he call you when he was leaving the room? Fernahariadbach. It means my darling in Welsh, my little darling.
She gazed at him challengingly, but he didn't seem inclined to mock her.
My mother often speaks of your father, he said. I did not think he would be like that.
Like what?
His gaze slid away from hers.
My own father died before I was born. I thought perhaps I would see him when I died, but I have not. The dead go somewhere far away. I cannot follow them.
Why not?
Lucy had once asked Jessamine what happened after one died. Jessamine had replied that she did not know, that the limbo ghosts inhabited was not the land of death.
I am held here, said Jessie. When the sun rises, I go into darkness. I am not conscious again until the night. If there is an afterlife, I have never seen it.
But you can speak to your sister and mother, said Lucy. They must know how odd all this is. But can they keep it a secret? Has Grace ever told James?
She has not, said Jessie. The Blackthorns are used to keeping secrets. It is only by accident that I discovered Grace was meeting your brother tonight. I saw her writing to James, though she didn't know I was there.
Oh, yes, the secret rendezvous, Lucy said. Are you worried that Grace will be ruined?
It was distressingly easy for a young lady to be ruined, her reputation destroyed if she was found alone with a gentleman. The mother always hoped the gentleman would do the right thing and marry the lady, rather than doom her to a life of shame, even if he didn't love her, but it was far from a sure thing. And if he didn't, one could be sure no other man would go near her. She would never marry. Lucy thought of Eugenia.
Nothing so trivial, said Jessie. You know the stories of my grandfather, I am sure.
Lucy raised an eyebrow. The one who turned into a great worm because of demon pox and was slain by my father and uncles.
I feared your parents would not have considered it the kind of tale suitable for a young lady's ears, said Jessie. I see that was an idle concern.
They tell it every Christmas, said Lucy smugly.
Jessie stood up. Lucy could not help but glance at the mirror over the vanity, where she could see the reflection of her own face, but not Jessie. A girl in an empty room, talking to herself.
Grandfather Benedict dabbled in a great deal of black magic, he said, and his relationship with demons. He shuddered. When he died, he left a Cerberus demon behind him in the greenhouse. Its mandate is to protect our family.
The demon James saw in the greenhouse, but he killed it, and when the Enclave searched the grounds, they found nothing.
The Cerberus had been bred with a certain demonic plant, said Jessie. When slain, it drops pods that at first look harmless. After some hours, they hatch and become new Cerberus demons. By now, they would be full grown.
Lucy felt a chill.
What do you fear?
Grace left the house without my mother's knowledge, indeed, against her express orders. The newborn Cerberus demons would have sensed it. My grandfather instilled them with a mandate to protect our family. They will go forth to find Grace and retrieve her, said Jessie.
But how can you be sure? Why would the new demons inherit the mandate of the old?
I read it in my grandfather's papers, Jessie said. He hoped to create an obedient demon that would give birth to new demons when slain, ones that would remember all their progenitor knew. Believe me, I never thought his plan would actually work.
Grandfather was as mad as a hatter, but by the time I became aware of what was going on, it was too late. But,
Lucy spluttered,
will they harm Grace?
No. They regard her as a Blackthorn, but if Herondale, if your brother, is with her, they will regard him as an enemy. He killed their progenitor in the greenhouse. They will attack him, and it will be no easy task to fend off a group of Cerberus demons alone.
Not only would James be alone, Lucy was not even sure he was armed.
What does your mother know of this? Surely she could not have wanted a demon on her property.
My mother resents shadow hunters, and not without reason. I think she has always felt protected by the presence of the Cerberus in the greenhouse. Jessie sighed. To be honest, I am not even sure she knows about the new demons. I only worked out what had happened when I saw them leaving the manor, and, as a ghost, I could not stop them.
His voice was full of frustration. I have not even been able to find my mother to warn her what is going on. Shaking her head, Lucy fell to her knees in front of the trunk at the foot of her bed that held her weaponry. She threw it open. Dust puffed up. Inside were stacks of daggers, seraph blades, knives, chains, darts, and other such items, all wrapped daintily in folded velvet. Noiselessly, Jessie appeared beside her. Cerberus demons are not small.
You might wish to bring a few more foot soldiers.
I was planning on that, said Lucy, taking a small axe out of her trunk. What will you do in the meantime?
Try to track down my mother and send her after Grace. She can tell the Cerberus demons to stand down. They'll listen to her. Do you have any idea where James and Grace are meeting?
Lucy yanked a satchel that held several daggers and seraph blades out of the trunk and looped it over her shoulder.
You mean you don't know?
No, I did not see all of the letter, said Jessie. Do you think you can find them?
I'm certainly going to try.
Lucy rose, axe in hand.
Let me tell you something, Jessie Blackthorn. Your mother may have reason to be resentful of shadow hunters, but if her ridiculous demons hurt my brother, I will have no pity. I shall beat her to death with her own stupid hat.
And with that, she flung open her bedroom window, crawled out onto the ledge, and dropped noiselessly into the night.
9. Deadly Wine. No growth of moor or coppice, no heather flower or vine, but bloomless buds of poppies, green grapes of proserpine. Pale beds of blowing rushes, where no leaf blooms or blushes, save this whereout she crushes, for dead men deadly wine. Algernon Charles Swinburne, The Garden of Proserpine. Cordelia and Matthew went only a short way down the alley before a door rose up in front of them. It shimmered in the side of a worn-looking wall, and Cordelia suspected that to mundanes the opening would not be visible at all. Inside was a narrow hallway, whose walls were heavy red cloth tapestries hanging from ceiling to floor, obscuring whatever was behind them. At the end of the hall was another door, also painted red.
When this place is not home to the salon, it is a gaming house, Matthew whispered to Cordelia as they approached the door. There is even a trapdoor in the roof, so that if they get raided by the police, the gamesters can escape over the eaves. The door was flung suddenly open. Lounging in the space it revealed was a tall man in an iron grey jacket and trousers. In the dimness, his hair appeared utterly white. Cordelia thought he must be in his 60s at least, but as they approached, she realized his face was young and sharp, his eyes dark purple. This must be Malcolm Fade, High Warlock of London. Most warlocks had a mark that set them apart, a physical sign of their demon blood, blue skin, horns, claws made of stone. Malcolm's eyes were certainly an unearthly shade, like amethysts.
Three of you this time, he said to Anna.
She nodded. Three.
We try to limit the number of shadow hunters in the salon, said Malcolm. I prefer Nephilim to feel outnumbered among downworlders, as it is so often the other way around.
A woman's voice called from behind him. Malcolm didn't turn but smiled.
You do enliven the place, though, as Hypatia reminds me.
He thrust the door wide and stood aside to allow them to enter.
Come in. Are you armed?
Never mind, of course you are. You're shadow hunters. Anna passed through the doorway, and then Matthew, Cordelia last. As she stepped by Malcolm, he peered down into her face.
There's no Blackthorn blood in your family, is there? He asked suddenly.
No, none, I don't think, said Cordelia, surprised.
Good.
He ushered them past. Inside, the salon was a series of interconnected rooms,